Government Operations and Elections Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum. Representative McFarland, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
I'll move the minutes of March 3rd, Madam Chair.
Representative McFarland moves the minutes of Thursday, March 3rd. Do we have any discussion, changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of the minutes of Thursday, March 3rd, please signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. We will move on to our first order of business, House File 756. Representative Stensrud, are you ready to proceed with the bill?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Stensrud, we will have Representative Murray move it for you.
Madam Chairman, I would move House File 756 be approved and passed along to the government, State Gov Finance.
Okay. Representative Murray moves House File 756 be recommended to pass and be referred to State Government Finance. I understand that you have an amendment to make it the same as it passed in Governor and Representative Downey's bill, but do you have that ready yet? Do you want to just proceed with your bill, or do you want to, or is that amendment ready?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, I think what we can do is, if we pass it and move it to State Government Finance, we'll make the amendment there, and I think that'll make all parties happy. And that way, we'll have some time to actually get it in writing, have it be written.
Okay, so we're just going to proceed as is then, with no amendments.
Correct.
Okay. Okay, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 756 is really a simple bill, and it simply gives direction to the commissioner to design a performance appraisal system for employees in the executive branch. You know, there are millions of people around the country and around Minnesota that are evaluated and paid on work product and performance in private industry, and this concept has existed since time began. You know, simply a concept that the best and the strongest performers are rewarded the most. So we know in all our work environment there are all different levels of work performance. You know, some are work very hard and are dedicated to the job, and some are not. So this bill, in a small way, begins to allow the supervisors in the executive branch to reward their employees for performance towards agreed upon goals in their workplace. So there are three areas of performance that we've stipulated here, and that's on line 112. It's the individual's performance of their individual goals, their individual contribution towards the department goals, and also the performance of their entire department or agency, which is pretty standard method of evaluation around the country, and that is. The appraisal would impact no less than 5% of the employee's salary or wages. And I would be happy to answer any questions for the committee.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stensrud, could you just speak to the amendment that was made in the other committee so we don't have to talk about that issue?
Thank you. Representative Stensrud.
Madam Chair and members. Yes, it just came to my attention this morning that this was already been through this committee as an amendment to Representative Downey's Bill 192, and it was our intention to include the executive branch, but not to include MNSCU, and that was taken care of through an amendment for Representative Downey's bill, but not with the original language of this. So certainly that was not my intention, and we are willing to work with that and make that change to exclude Minnesota State Colleges and Universities.
Okay, Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I guess I'd have more comfort if we did that here than to say we're going to pass it on. I'm going to do it at the next committee because I don't serve on the next committee, so but be that as it may, I guess the one question I have here on the bill that kind of bothers me a little bit here, it says at least 5% of a person's base salary shall be withheld and use as performance. What's to stop a supervisor from saying, well, we're going to do 20% of your salary, and I'm going to do 10% of this person's salary, or I'm going to do 50% of your salary and hold it back for performance? What's to prevent that? Because the way the language is, it's just at least 5%. Well, that's the floor, but I could say 100% of your salary is going to be based on performance, and we'll have to see what happens at the end of the year, and then we'll pay you your salary. So,
Representative Stensrud.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. I think, you know, we give the direction to the commissioner to design the plan. We wanted a minimum of 5%. I guess your question is there some supervisor somewhere that could go off on a tangent and change the performance? But I don't think that they would be able to do that, given that it comes from a commissioner level. I guess they would do that. I would give the latitude to the commissioner to design that plan, and also the parameters and limits of that, with the only guidance that, you know, no less than 5%. And I would expect that they would probably come up with an upper end for that. And I just didn't want to micromanage from a statute here.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stensrud. Well, I think this whole bill is about micromanaging what the executive department does, and I got some concerns there also that we as the legislature are telling the executive branch to do something or how they have to do something, and I think we're trying to micromanage them. I've seen a lot of these bills come through so far this year, but it's still that my question has to do with, as I said, if it's at least 5%, I would be more comfortable that you said 5%, and we could do that then at least, because at least means it could be, like I said, it could be up to 100%, but the minimum, it has to be 5% withheld for these performance bonuses, and whether it's the supervisors or the commissioners designing it, a commissioner could come in and say, I want 100% of it, we're going to base all your salary on that, and if I don't like what you did at the end of the year, we're not going to pay you, and I think that could happen under the way this language is. The other thing is it opens us up to a lot of idiosyncrasies. I mean, it's not the word I'm thinking of, but just as a supervisor, I may not like you or I may not care for you, so you're not going to get the bonus because I don't want to give it to you, and I can find a way to not pay it to you. Or it also ties you to the fact that maybe I'm doing a fantastic job, and my coworker here, Frank, is not doing a fantastic job, and then my performance is tied to the fact that he's not doing his job. Our department doesn't do well, and so my bonus is I don't get my other 5% of my salary. And how do we deal with that, Representative Stensrud?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Nelson. No, I think that's a valid point, but it's really a real world situation. I think in the marketplace, if the entire company is performing very poorly and has lost market share and is very poorly performing, there's not a lot to go around, and there would be no reason for great, you know, performance bonuses, if you will. If the entire organization is doing poorly, I think that should be taken into account in the formula for the performance appraisal. Now, that's just one of the three areas, because yeah, there are some things that are beyond your control. You know, you have your own individual goals that would be agreed upon. You know, I need to work on this or that, but then, you know, how does a person fit in to you know, the whole world if their work environment in their division? You know, what am I contributing towards the success of my division? I have control on that, and you know, if Representative Hornstein is not performing as well, and you know, then he's going to be dinged on his performance evaluation for his individual performance, towards those goals. So I just think it allows us to reward those and deal with a good reality of how well is the division doing. You know, a rising tide floats all boats. So if the division is doing really well, you know, then that's going to work in your favor, regardless of your performance on that particular issue. So it kind of does cut both ways.
Representative Stensrud, why did you choose Representative Hornstein as an example?
I I'm the one that picked my co-worker, Representative Hornstein.
He knows me well.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I merely followed the lead.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stensrud. Thanks for bringing the bill forward. I think these discussions are helpful, and we should always be reevaluating how we do things. But I have a question on number three on line 1.16. I understand the sort of private sector model of performance of the entire agency, but it seems to me, though, that sometimes, particularly in government, there could be a situation where the reason that a particular outcome wasn't met wasn't that people weren't working well, but maybe in some cases they might need more people. In some it might be fewer, but in some it might be more. Let's say, for example, that an environmental agency has as a goal cleaning up a certain number or proportion of lakes, or making sure that the mercury levels get below a certain number, a certain percentage. And that goal isn't met. It just isn't. One of the reasons it might not be met is that they just don't have enough people to do it. And so could you address that a little bit? I mean, this sort of assumes a model where it's not met because maybe people aren't doing the job well enough or right, or maybe you don't have the right people doing those jobs, that kind of thing. But what do you say about the situation where maybe it's just a person power issue in terms of quantity? Do you think your bill gives managers that flexibility, or is that something that you'd need to address in a different way?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Simon. No, I think that's a fair question. I think it goes into how are you determining what the outcomes are for that agency. I think if you assume some monumental goal, you would know on January 1st how many employees you would have, and you would realize, I would hope that the heads of all these departments would be able to work with the commissioner and have agreed upon goals. I mean, it would sort of be a working document. It wouldn't be something that was just handed down. I wouldn't think that the commissioner would come up with the specific, outcomes for that agency to be included in the specific evaluation. I think there has to be a little bit of team effort in coming up with some of those goals on an individual basis and in those separate departments. So I guess an outright answer, yes, if there were some really huge outcomes that were targeted and written down as a goal, yeah, it's quite possible that those were unrealistic and you wouldn't achieve those goals and, you wouldn't be evaluated as highly on that portion of the three criteria. But then again, I would hope that, we have reasonable people in these positions that can determine, what good outcomes are and what good goals are and can work together to come up with, something, that would meet all the needs.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick follow-up. And thank you, Representative Stensrud. I appreciate that, your honesty. I think one of the things I'm thinking about, too, is sometimes we in the legislature impose goals, along with a gubernatorial signature, of course, but we impose goals on agencies. I agree with what you're saying. I think a good manager would see how many employers he or she has at a given time and wouldn't kind of bite off more than they could chew. But sometimes we impose certain goals, whether they're realistic or not, on agencies or on the state as a whole. I'm just wondering, too, and forgive me, I came in a little bit late, so if you're repeating, I apologize to the committee members, but are you comfortable talking about what, if any, consultations have you had with executive branch folks about this in terms of feasibility or language? In terms of talking with the stakeholders, have you had a chance to meet with anyone from the administration or just kind of discuss the broad brushstrokes here?
Representative Stensrud?
Madam Chair, Representative Simon. I've not had direct conversations yet. I think this is really a first step in the discussion. And given the fact that it's quite likely a minimum of a 5% portion of their entire pay, it's really a rather modest, first step. And I don't see that as something that's so paradigm shifting that it would really have a very negative outcome, I guess. I'm thinking it's as a realistic first step in the process. And it's really a reality. I mean, we want to push for excellence in the government just as we push for excellence in private industry and for the entrepreneurs. And I think this really is a first step that really allows them to an opportunity to be seen in their department as somebody who really does their job really well and to be differentiated from those perhaps that have areas for improvement.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Stensrud. I keep hearing you talk about bonuses, that these are going to be bonuses, yet the bill language says we're going to take 5% of their base salary. So these aren't bonuses. This is their base salary that they're currently getting. So what we're going to cut them 5% is the way, if these are bonuses, we're going to be cutting these employees 5% on the assumption that they're not doing their jobs right now. And I keep hearing you say that we have good managers. So there's another assumption there that all the managers that work for the state of Minnesota are good and great managers, and it's just the employees that are doing the job that are below average or subpar, that are causing the problems. I mean, that's what I'm hearing in this. This is the way it hits me. And to me, if I was a state employee, that I'm out there working hard, this would be an insult to the fact that every day I get up and I do go to work and do my job the best I can do, regardless of all the obstacles that get put in my way by, if I'm a public defender and I get 500 cases where last year I was only projected to have 100, and I'm not going to get all 500 of those cases tried because there's just not the number of hours in the day, or if I'm a snowplow driver and the first of the year we figure we're going to have this much snow, and then this year we've had a record amount of snow and that's lasting a lot longer than that it is, or whatever department you're in. These are the, like I said, there's assumptions there that I'm hearing, and maybe I'm hearing them falsely, but I'm hearing them that all of our state employees are doing a bad job, and they've got all these great managers, and we just manage them better, we're gonna solve all these problems. And I guess that's just a concern I have here. I mean, look, number one, like I said, we're taking 5% out of their salary, so we're going to be cutting them 5%. And if we choose to say that they're not doing their job and don't meet the performance standards, they're not going to get this bonus that's part of their base salary.
Representative Stensrud.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson. Well, I think it's important there are managers who will also be getting the same sort of evaluation. So it's not a managers versus the workers, and certainly that would never be my intention. I think if a manager is not meeting their goals and expectations, they should not receive, you know, compensation either in a performance appraisal. And the question, you're correct. This is not an extra bonus on top of their current pay. That you're accurate in that. And it merely is taking their pay and saying that 5% of it should be looked at as a performance pay or evaluated, then, so that it's not, I beg to differ, it's just sort of in how you look at what's your perspective. It's not that we look at every employee and say, you're doing a bad job, you're not going to get your 5% unless you do better. I think it's looking at the people, and if you're doing a great job, that you're going to do well and you're going to receive a good appraisal. And I guess, you know, there can be questions, you know, whether there are managers that are out to get you or might not evaluate you well. You know, that's possible. But, you know, that's, you know, we live in an imperfect world, I guess. Anything's possible in that regard.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this is a 5% or more cut of their base salary that they then have the opportunity to earn back. That's what you're saying here. This is a 5% cut in their salary, at least a 5% cut in their salary.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Nelson. No, those would be your words. I would not call it a 5% cut, but it would be a change in sort of the way they're looking at, you know, how they're getting paid. And I think it would give an opportunity for those who do well. It's just going to be a recognition of the ones that perform very well, you know, are going to receive that.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And we used to have a representative here who always asked the question, what problem arose that we get to this level? Is there a problem in some executive branch with employees that you're aware of, that we should be aware of, that made you do this?
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Scalzi, you know, I don't have, there's no specific, you know, glaring problem, but I think we have humans working for us, you know, in the executive branch and, you know, in all places in the government. And working in industry, you know, life is a bell-shaped curve. And anyone who disagrees with that, you know, I'd love to have a conversation with you offline. There's probably 20, there's a great percentage of people who are performing pretty well in the middle, and there are people who perform very well, and there are people who are underperforming. And as a manager used to hire and make hiring decisions, you know, sometimes we need to help people make career choices. You know, if some people are not happy in their job, and if all you do is give encouragement to continue doing the same old things, you know, it's important to have tools in your performance appraisal systems, you know, on a quarterly or an annual basis to at least address some of those areas for improvement and have an opportunity to do so.
Representative Scalzi.
And just as a follow-up, and I know there's lots of things because we've made a lot of cuts in the last couple of bienniums. And so I think, you know, if you have a goal, for instance, for your highway patrol, if our goal is to have fewer incidents on the highways and yet we've cut the numbers, or if our goal is to have fewer people taking too many fish and yet we've cut the numbers of conservation officers. So legislative action sometimes gets in the way of targeted outcomes. And I don't see that in here, that there would be any wiggle room other than to say if the targeted outcomes aren't being met, you're going to lose 5% of your pay. And it may be something that the legislature did. We do things here every day that are, we really don't know what the consequences are. And we've looked in this committee at what we've done to people, and we're going to have to make some changes. So I just don't see that in here. I think this bill to me looks like state employees are not doing their job. We were presupposing that at the beginning, and I don't hear that from people. So maybe we're coming from a different mindset, but I've been here for 6 years. I have not heard that from people. I think we're still running the state pretty well, and that's why I asked if there was a problem, specifically if there's a problem not caused by legislative action.
Okay, we have a few people who've asked to testify. If we could take those now. Mayip? And I apologize, I always have a very difficult time with your last name, so if you could just please remind me how to pronounce your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a difficult time with it till last week, actually. Madam Chair, members, I'm Richard Kajewski, Legislative Affairs Director for the Minnesota Association of Professional Employees. In my capacity, I represent 13,000 state professional employees. In lines 1.24 through lines 2.4, an employee can receive their cost of living or progression increase in this bill if their supervisor certifies two things: that they have satisfactory individual performance, and that the supervisor justifies spending the funds on the employee's compensation. And this really overshadows our collective bargaining agreement as it stands today. You as elected officials in the legislature get the opportunity to approve the collective bargaining agreements. You have in the past. You've approved that language in those our current language in the collective bargaining agreement when they're negotiated. And those are predicated on satisfactory performance. We don't get automatic step increases unless our performance meets a satisfactory level or above. The bill says it's based on individual performance in line 2.2, and then yet it contradicts that in number 3 in line 1.16 that holds the individual employee accountable for the performance of an entire agency. One of the issues we have with that, we have no idea nor any control over what the targeted outcomes for that agency would be or who determines that. Yet this bill holds 5% or more of an employee's pay based on those factors. There's a concern over what happens if a performance appraisal is not done, or is not done months late, or is done months later, which happens. In fact, Madam Chair, members, I think if you could get the information from the state of Minnesota, there isn't a single agency, with the exception of a small board or council, that's in compliance with that. We feel our collective bargaining agreement currently addresses this issue more than adequately. Our contract requires an annual performance appraisal, or there's a consequence for doing that or for not doing that. It's not grievable. It provides a means for discipline for employees to document an employee's performance. And I think that's critical here. If an employee is not doing their job, it's incumbent upon the supervisor to coach address those issues up to including discipline and discharge. That's how the system works. This system here just holds 5% of their pay, doesn't give them any opportunity to correct it, doesn't make any requirements on a supervisor to address it, doesn't allow a time period for it to be corrected, and there's no corrective action. I heard the author talk about the private sector getting bonuses. This isn't a bonus for state employees. And for the few of you who were in state government, I believe 3 years ago, you remember a bill that MAPE brought forward that addressed the statute that requires the state of Minnesota to have a system to evaluate all state employees. The system the state uses is the Hay Study. It requires them to evaluate their fair market worth. But nowhere in that statute does it say the state has to follow that. So although positions in state government might have 12 steps to them, at that time, 3 years ago, 70% of the employees I represent were paid below fair market value because the state does not have to follow that system. So their own system evaluates them at a higher rate of pay than what they're even being paid. This isn't a bonus. This is their wages. So I resent the fact that the author believes that 5% is modest. I don't think it's modest for anybody. Our people work every single day. They work hard, and they work for that pay. Employees around here deserve the same respect. Their pay shouldn't be held if they're working hard every day. They should be paid that day for the work they're doing. And Madam Chair, this goes too far. This surpasses our collective bargaining agreement language that each and every one of you get an opportunity to vote on. And frankly, I think it makes a mockery of the state system. Our contract is very restrictive and makes some requirements of supervisors to actually supervise employees and to evaluate them based on that performance. With that, Madam Chair, if there's any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr.
I'm
glad I'm not the only one.
Whatever. My tongue can't say that. Anyway, question I have, do you consider this at least a 5% cut in your pay, like I asked Representative Stensrud, or do you consider this a bonus?
Mr. Kajewski?
Madam Chair and Representative Nelson, this is pay based on the Hay Study that the state chooses to use as part of their requirement statute.
So Senator Nelson?
I guess the question, maybe I didn't ask the question correctly. So do you consider this, if this bill were to go, would it be signed into law, that would you consider this bonus money, or would you consider this at least a 5% cut in your pay?
Mr. Kajewski.
Madam Chair and members, I consider that at least a 5% cut in pay.
Thank you, Ms.
Although I guess I'm having a hard time understanding that, where they could, the whole point of this is it could potentially be, but how we could just say that this is a 5% cut is not clear to me either. I can understand your argument, but to say it's a 5% cut, I think is overextending what the bill does, Representative Nelson.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess the way I read this is that it's at least 5% of their base salary, which is base salary that has been through collective bargaining, been bargained for. Mm. And if we're going to turn this into a bonus that they can earn, if my coworker doesn't perform as well and doesn't get that, then if they don't get the 5%, if they get zero of it, that's a 5% cut in their base salary. At least that's the way I'm looking at it. If I earn half of that bonus, then maybe it's only a 2.5% cut, but it says at least 5% is going to be withheld. So, I mean, if we decide it's going to be 10% in this department, so that's 10%. I'm going to be cut all the way through the year, and maybe I can earn that back. There's no promises on that, and even if we get that at the end of the year and we don't have any money, we'll say, well, you did everything right, but we can't give you the money because we don't got it to give. So, to me, I'm looking at it at the beginning, it's a cut.
Well, Representative Nelson, I think it's fair that the way you said that and asked that question, that it is at least a 5% cut, I find very unfair, because the whole point is that they go through the appraisal, and so it certainly could turn out where it's not a cut at all. And so I just want to be clear. I understand that you don't like that you're frustrated with the bill, but I think it's very misleading to say that it's a cut, and it's necessarily a cut.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Kajewski.
I guess in response to Representative Nelson, we would perceive that as a bonus. Our employees get paid every 2 weeks for the work that they do for the state of Minnesota and the citizens. And if there's pay being withheld until an annual date, we would perceive that as bonus pay that, you know, the determining factors, which aren't even outlined in this bill, will determine whether or not that employee receives that.
Thank you. Representative Beard, did you have a question?
Well, perhaps it's a question, but I'm trying to think this through, and I'm sorry I had to step out and meet with the Humane Society folks, but I missed some of the discussion, so I don't know if the amendment was discussed or not. But in looking at Section 2 on Page 2 and listening to the discussion between the testifier and Representative Nelson, I'm going to make a suggestion that at least 5% of the base salary and wages otherwise payable is probably poorly worded if the idea is to have some sort of an incentive program. First of all, just an observation, if this bill were to pass, any existing collective bargaining agreement that's in place now would not be affected, as I'm understanding it, that it would only be for new agreements negotiated in upcoming bienniums or whoever they're negotiated. So anything that's in place now would not be affected. Only the new collective bargaining agreements entered into on or after that date. It says on 2.21. However, I'm not sure that maybe this isn't the real problem, and it could be reworded that perhaps an additional 5% of any compensation could be part of a bonus system or a reward system. And that way, it's going to end up that way anyhow, because I'm sure that if this were to be law, and I'm not sure that I'm supporting the bill, I'm just talking theoretically here, if it were to become law, any agreement that was entered into going forward, a collective bargaining unit would probably just establish 95% of whatever the number is going to be, in effect, your new 100% of your wage. And the 5% would have the effect of being some sort of an incentive pool that people could earn an additional part of. Let's assume that that's the case, that this language is changed so that we don't cut a base. You negotiate something, but that we make an additional 5% of payroll available to the managerial portion of the unit for rewarding exceptional behavior. Would you find that problematic, or could you think of a way where that might be able to work in a collective bargaining setting?
Mr. Kajewski.
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm not familiar with the supervisory unit's contract, to be real frank with you. I don't represent those members of the within state government. What I would say is that we negotiate base pay, and I understand that the section wouldn't change anything until July 1st, 2011. I think that makes a lot of sense. That's when our contract actually expires.
Okay.
Number one, and number two, I think that, you know, the start of the fiscal year is the appropriate time if you're taking away an annual salary. When you talk about performance and achieving goals and that sort of thing, I perceive this bill, as do the employees I represent, as taking away 5% of their base pay to determine on things that, in fact, they don't have a total influence over, which is in any state agency, in line 1.16, evaluating the performance of the entire agency toward meeting targeted outcomes for the agency. That's hard to get past, number one. Number two, if employees achieve an exceptional rating or do something unique to state government outside of their performance appraisal, they're entitled to an achievement award based on collective bargaining. Now, our achievement awards have been froze for many, many years. So other than outside of Minsky, which I can't speak on behalf of, state government workers who do something exceptional, create a huge savings in government or do any sort of thing, including factors for the LEAN program, which I believe this committee's heard testimony on, don't receive anything for that. So this is really a base salary that I would argue they're getting paid every 2 weeks for the work that they did during that two-week period of time.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Madam Chair, just
long for
having some rational discussion about the concept. The award that they can get, is that a cash award, or is that a citation for, is it something that actually has some compensation value to the employee, like additional time off or something, or is it just a, I don't want to denigrate gold stars, but did they get us, you know, something like we used to get when we were kids? So. Symbolic. Thank you. Is it symbolic, or is it actually compensation that's valuable?
Madam Chair, Representative Beard, I believe achievement awards can be awarded through one-time compensation up mm-hmm. to, don't quote me on this, but I believe it's up to $1,500, and a one-step increase.
Well, Madam Chair.
But I can't say that that's true for all collective bargaining.
And Representative Beard.
Madam Chair, for purposes of this discussion, that's helpful to know that there's something in the details aren't important. I think the author of the bill is probably listening to our discussion and hearing your concern and is thinking about, as it moves forward, how it can become, instead of, you know, because this is politics, perceptions, everything. We don't see a cut. You see a cut. Hey, it's a cut then. How do we recraft this bill so that you negotiate a base, but there is somehow incentive or some room for rewarding exceptional behavior or developing some sort of esprit de corps or team morale that may be tied to a unit performing above and beyond or something like that. And I'm not even asking for a response. It's just comments that I'd like the author to hear and other members to think on and comment on.
Madam Chair and members, I think I would speak on behalf of probably all labor that's present here today. Mm-hmm. If it's a system you're looking for to reward exceptional behavior, I'd be more than willing to work with the author, as would I would assume all the labor representatives in the room here today. Okay. Glad to do
it. It's helpful, Madam Chair.
Thank you. We do have another person who'd like to testify, Russ Stanton from the Interfaculty Association. Did you have a question, Representative Green, for Mr. Kajewski? Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Kajewski, you could come back. I didn't.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Green?
Did you allude to the fact that that bonus payment system was frozen or has been?
Mr. Kajewski?
Madam Chair and Representative, I'm just jogging my memory. I know, I believe that system's been mostly frozen for about 7 years. And when I say frozen, I'm talking about a memo that has come from MMB to other state agencies. It's been internal document. Our employees haven't received it for 7 years, I'm guessing, at least.
Just wonder if maybe that could also be on the table in the discussions, taking what exists and unfreezing it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Stanton. Welcome,
Madam Chair. Julie Blyle from AFSCME would like to testify, and she has a dental appointment. Could it be possible to put her ahead of me? She's looking forward to that rather than being here.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. And I can probably talk to you now, but in an hour I probably won't sound so good. I'm going to take this from a little different standpoint. I'm Julie Blau, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. Mr. Kajewski just dissected the bill and went through the pieces within the bill before you. I'm going to take it from the standpoint that we are looking at, with the bills that have been introduced and moving through committee, a 15% wage reduction for the workforce, a wage freeze, a freeze in our steps. There's bills introduced to switch from defined benefit to defined contribution, and if that wasn't enough, there's another bill introduced to even prohibit defined contribution. There's bills moving forward that amend interest arbitration to make it an unfair process and biased to give the employer an unfair advantage. We have changes in various bills changing the definition of public employee in PLRA. Plus, we're facing an all-cuts budget the legislature has promised that they are going to deliver. In addition to that, there are other bills that are before us that prescribe and mandate what can be done with regard to the state contract, and that's how we see this bill. This bill prescribes and mandates changes in 43A and changes to PLRA. And with that, I'd just like to say, when folks say we're not Wisconsin, I don't know what meets the definition, but this is changing collective bargaining and eliminating the collective bargaining rights of public employees as they go to the negotiating table, and we would urge you to defeat this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, I guess we'll move on to Mr. Stanton again.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the Interfaculty Organization. That's the faculty at the 7 state universities. My objection to the bill, or opposition to the bill, is based on the fact that the way the bill is worded right now, it would include our state university faculty and community college faculty, et cetera. And we would be opposed to that because we actually have a performance pay system in effect. It's called promotion and tenure and promotion. We have four ranks. You don't get tenure by seat time. You have usually a five-year probationary period. You submit a professional development plan that you have to respond to five goals or criteria set in the contract through negotiations. A lot of people do not get tenure, and they therefore move on. And then promotions and rank are based on, again, a performance plan where you're monitored by your peers, where you're monitored by supervisors, and there is pay connected to that, because if you're promoted, for instance, from an associate to a full professor, you get a 4.85% pay increase under our contract. And that is a system of performance pay that's deeply embedded in academe. It's widely accepted by the employees for many decades. And it's accepted by management, and I don't know why we would want to impose a new type of performance pay that isn't accepted on a system that is there. As you know, we have a separate board that is charged with managing the system. They can give performance pay if they wish, and in fact, they did give performance pay to the chancellor and the presidents and so forth this past year. Very controversial with our folks, so they do have that authority, and in fact, I believe the community college faculty do set aside a pool of money for pay adjustments. So, I guess at this point, I had suggested an amendment. The language that I lifted was the same as in House File 192 dealing with the pay freeze that exempted the Minsky employees. I understand there are some problems with that. I've talked to the author about that. I don't think it's his intention to include the employees, and I'd be more than willing to work with the author on that amendment. We don't think that the pay for performance fits our system very well. Thank you.
Thank you. The member from St. Louis Park, Representative Simon.
Thank you. Well, there are two members from St. Louis Park on this committee, of course, Representative Winkler and I. He represents the northern half. I represent the southern half. We are both pleased jointly to let you know that we have with us here today some ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. They're participating in the Capitol Historic Site Voice of the People, Your Role in Minnesota Government Tour. So I just wanted us to all recognize them and thank them for being with us here today.
Thank you. Did anybody have any questions for Mr. Stanton? Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stanton, I wonder if, I have some comments about the Minsky Executive Performance, Pay for Performance Program. And I don't think it's a very good model for what we want to do in state government. But I wonder, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I wonder if you could share with the committee some of your experience with the pay-for-performance system that you have.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, we did not voice very loud objection to those pay bonuses, mainly because they were a negotiated agreement, and we believe that when somebody makes an agreement, you live up to the terms of the agreement, just out of principle. But I will say, you know, it was very demoralizing. We went out 2 years ago. I mean, we saw that the state was in terrible shape. We were the first union in the nation to come forward and say, we'll take a pay freeze for 2 years. And if you look at the subcommittee and employee relations, the cost of our contract was over 2 years was 0.2%, including all pensions, all health care, everything, compensation together. And in fact, it was even less than that because the health care came in flat this year. And, you know, quite frankly, I've had members tell me that we as a union were kind of fools. You know, we made the sacrifice. you know, I mean, their feeling is that it's just like in Wall Street, those who have the greatest control usually find their performance the greatest, the best. And so, I mean, that I do think it has a demoralizing effect on employees as far as challenging their right to get it. It was something that they was agreed to in their contracts, so I guess we would we would not object to paying something that was agreed to.
Senator Winkler.
Madam Chair, it's just, I think, important to understand that when you create this kind of pay-for-performance system, the criteria that you use for determining whether somebody met their performance goals or not is the most important thing. And in the private sector, you know, most of the time, they officially have a system where they evaluate an individual employee's performance, and then they look at basically the amount of profit that they have to share with employees. But in reality, it's all determined by the amount of money they make. And if they make good money, then they're going to be generous and share it with employees. And maybe if somebody does something really bad, they won't get it. But it's not really a true, it's not a very effective system for encouraging employees to do a better job. Because when you've got a pool out there where, in here, you've got, you know, where your program and your agency have to do well before you can qualify, you know, the individual can do something, but most of what is going to determine their bonus is way beyond their control. So it's not a very good incentive system for improving performance. And what can happen is that management just chooses favorites and rewards the people who are on their team. And I'm not sure that that's entirely true with Minsky, but I did send a letter to David Olson, the chair of the Minsky board, and ask him for the objective criteria that they use for evaluating the university presidents and for awarding these bonuses, and they didn't have any. There was a negotiated agreement, but there was really no structure to it. It was just sort of who management liked or who they thought generally was doing a good job. And that's what the real concern for a bill like this is to me, is that you're just giving management all the control and the power to decide, you know, who's on board with their team this year and who's not. And it's not, just by saying performance pay and appraisal, you're not actually delivering that. You're just putting the words in place. And you can't create better management by having this program on paper.
So we do have another person who wants to testify, Mary Jo George from the Nurses Association. Welcome
Thank
to the committee.
You, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mary Jo George with the Minnesota Nurses Association. I just want to be very brief, but want to say that we are, for the record, opposed to this bill as well. We represent 700 nurses working in state service. They are essential employees because they are taking care of patients under the state's care. And we do see this as a interference in our collective bargaining rights. As we read it, this would supersede our M&A contract language that we just negotiated and that was settled, that will be effective July 1st, 2011. I do want to let you know that nurses already are subject to satisfactory performance criteria that's in our contract in order for them to get a step increase, and we believe they should be able to get that increase if they are deemed satisfactory, and yet we read this bill as that it is a withhold of 5% before they are entitled any increase. We also do have a performance bonus component. I think you heard from May previously, it's called the Achievement Award, but we have no record of anybody receiving one in at least 2 to 3 years at a minimum because of the financial pressure. So we're very doubtful that that would happen again, given the $5 billion deficit. And then just lastly, I want to just say, you know, I agree with a lot of the folks who've talked today about just what obligation is there of the state to provide working conditions that are safe for nurses. This really puts the weight on the employee. We have nurses that are underpaid in our government sector. They are working in unsafe conditions, and this bill does nothing to look at what sort of obligation there is for the government to provide opportunities for them to work in safe conditions. We've had nurses actually disciplined for calling the police in threatening unsafe conditions in our community-based mental health treatment centers, and we just feel like this is the wrong approach, so we appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Charge. And I just wanted to comment on something that you said. I just want to make sure everyone understands that this is line 2.20 and 2.21 points out that this section applies to collective bargaining agreements entered into on or after July 1st, 2011. So I think your first comments, but I just want to be sure that we're all on the same page there. Did anybody have any questions for Ms. George? Thank you. Back to the bill. Representative Stenzer, did you want to comment on anything that you'd heard from any of the witnesses or any of the questions from members?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, just one comment. I think it's not set in stone in terms of how these three criteria are to be balanced. And I think we've heard from some of the witnesses, and perhaps some of Representative Winkler made the assumption that the agency performance of itself is to be heavily weighted. There's nothing in this bill that says that it will receive one third. It could be 50% individual. I really did not want to sort of handcuff the commissioner in terms of how they design this and how they weight those areas for performance and when they do the appraisals. So I think there's a great latitude in looking to how they weight those. So that would just be my final comment.
Representative Hancock.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Stenzrud. I think this this bill offers a really valuable opportunity. We've heard that now it seems like a lot of our state employees are based on a satisfactory performance of a job, and that becomes the standard. And I think what this bill does, in private business, I owned a small tire shop, and we paid bonuses based upon performance. And I think two things in business: incentive drives productivity, and accountability drives quality. And I think this bill brings both of these attributes to the process. It allows the employee to actually excel in something, and it produces an incentive, which produces a reward, so to speak, that is not just based upon a big stick, but it's the carrot out there that will motivate. And I think motivation of groups is also important. I found when I included all the mechanics into a certain goal, everyone pitched in and did their share a little bit more productively. And I think it also has the advantage here then of for management to really establish what are the priorities and what are the goals that each of our individuals and each of our collective groups are trying to attain. So it gives focus to the outcome that we're really looking for, and a way to reward the people that are involved in achieving that. And so I think maybe we need to work on some of the language in calling it a bonus or whatever. I think Representative Beard has an idea there that basically in negotiations, the negotiations are going to establish the base pay at about 95%, and the rest is going to be considered a bonus. And I think that's practically how it would work. And I think it's very important that you brought this bill forward, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. To that point, though, I own and operate a small business, too, but I would be very fearful of saying, and I don't have a union shop, but I would be very fearful to say that, okay, next year your base pay is going to be 95% of what it was this year, and if you perform well, and I assume they're going to perform well, then you get the rest of it. That would be very scary to me, and I don't think I could keep my employees if I did that. And I don't know what it's like in a tire shop, but you can't be changing the base pay and going backward unless there's, I just don't think that you can do that in private industry. And our goal in private industry is to make money. Our goal here at the state is to deliver efficient services for the most efficient services for precious taxpayer dollars. I think it's a very different set. For instance, highway patrol, things like that. I mean, that's not our goal in private industry. Our goal is to make money for the company and stay in business and provide jobs and health care, hopefully. But I'd be very hesitant to tell my employees they're going to make 5% less next year, and then if they perform, they get that extra 5%. That wouldn't cut it at my place.
Thank you, Representative Scalzi. Representative Stensrud, I guess I'm not quite reading it that way. I'm reading it that the 5% would be on based on collective bargaining, not based on today's wages. So it wouldn't necessarily be based on today's wages. So, Representative Scalzi?
Well, the bill doesn't have any mechanism for an extra 5% that's separate from the wages that I can see. I mean, it should say in there that, okay, there's going to be a different pot of money that's going to give you a bonus. I don't see that spelled out in the bill.
Well, I guess I guess the way I'm looking at it is it's saying total base salary and wages, but it's not saying anywhere specifically in the bill. And Representative Stensrud, this is your bill, so you can clarify. But I'm not seeing where it says that we're limited to whatever the wages are today, because this is applying to collective bargaining agreements entered into after this date. So, Representative Stensrud, perhaps you could clarify, because I think we're reading this bill a little differently. Maybe you could clarify. Would it be the 5% of what employees are already making today, or would it be based on the next negotiated agreement?
Yeah, I mean, it is. I mean, we want to work towards, Madam Chair, that you get a base salary, if you will, or you get a 95%, and that 5% of your base pay of what your annual compensation is or your quarterly compensation. And we haven't tied it into necessarily it only happens once a year. We wanted to not tie the hands of the person who designs the system to only annual. So I just left that open for negotiation or open for the design of the plan. So I guess as it moves forward as they negotiate future contracts, we would want this to be part of that so that there is additional. And I guess I held back a little bit. I think there could be an argument to be said that if there are those that are underperforming and it's so significantly obvious in all the departments, mm-hmm. that you could take their 5% and give it to another person who was extremely well-performing and give them a 10% bonus. But I didn't think that the political climate would go for that. I thought that might be too big of a culture shock. But that is done every day in private industry, in every corporate boardroom here, and in every Fortune 100, every Fortune 1000 company does that. Those who perform well get paid. And the person who does not so well receives a much smaller portion or even a zero portion of some of those incentives. So I thought that this was a more modest approach, just moving forward, getting the discussion going so that we could have this included in future contracts. And
I'd like to move to a vote here in a minute. Are there any other additional questions? Representative Nelson.
This may not be so much a question, but a concern I have, and it harkens back to a job that I got hired on and got partnered up with the guy on the job because he got hired the same day. And there was no, he was not a very good worker, but he was my partner. And in the construction trade where I came out of, you normally got partnered up with somebody on a job site because most jobs require two people. After about 3 weeks, the foreman called me aside and said, we're laying two guys off today and you're going because of so-and-so. And then he made the comment to me that you should, when you go out looking for jobs in the future, you should lose your partner because you're a good carpenter and I'd want to hire you and keep you on, but I got to get rid of two people. And your partner here is the guy that's dragging you down. And I looked at him and said, he wasn't my partner. You made him my partner. And now you're firing me because this guy's bad, and you're saying you don't want to let me go. And I see a lot of that could happen here. Again, you're judging people's pay on this with what your last comment here about if somebody's not doing well, we could take your pay and give it to somebody else. The subjectiveness of that of who we're going to and who's going to be deciding that and how those are going to be set up, it's so fuzzy in this bill right now that it could lead itself to a lot of abuse. And so, again, I'm going to vote against the bill. I don't think this is the way we go. I think the comments of Representative Beard, if it was set up in that direction where, okay, well, this is your base salary, we're going to have a pool here where you can earn up to 5% more based on performance standards, that's a model I wouldn't be opposed to. but the way this is written, the way I read this bill here, that's not what this is. What this is I'm seeing this as a 5% cut based on a lot of subjective things that maybe you can earn that 5% back, but there's no guarantee of that. So with that, I'm going to oppose the bill.
Any other questions before we take a vote? Okay. Well, Representative, we'll vote on it. I think there are some questions about the actual language of the bill, so I would recommend perhaps clarifying it, tightening up a little bit in its next step. Having said that, all those in favor of, I'll renew Representative Murray's motion. Representative Murray had moved that House File 756 be recommended to pass and re-referred to State Government Finance. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay.
No.
Nay.
Motion does prevail, and it will be moved on to State Government Finance. Next on the agenda, we have House File 753, Representative Howes. Welcome to the committee, Representative Howes. I believe Representative Quam would like to move your bill for you.
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 753 be approved and moved as appropriate to the floor.
Thank you. Representative Quam moves House File 753 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. To your bill, Representative Howes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to be very clear. This bill has nothing to do with the ability of Representative Nelson and any bonus or subtraction from his pay. That being said, although it depends how he votes, maybe I could talk to the governor. I don't know. I'm sorry. Okay, House File 753 brings some annexation law back to what it was prior to 2006. Section 1 of the bill simply adds a description of the procedures for initiating concurrent detachment and annexation. Section 2 allows the administrative law judge on certain conditions that he can simply place an order and make it happen. And then Section 3 shows that a property owner may initiate this with approval by one of, or a resolution of one of the cities, but I want to make very clear that this still then would go to an administrative law judge who would weigh all the facts, look at the effect it has on both cities, and look at the effect it would have on the owners, and then make a decision based on that. So without going any further, that's pretty much the whole part of the bill. I do have in my hand a study that was put together by the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Advisory Task Force, and the pages handed out page 19 of this report, because page 19 is the only second paragraph is basically the only recommendation that the task force made, and that was to revert back to pre-2006 law with regard to this type of annexation. And I know that there are two people or groups that would testify against the bill. I've talked to the townships and the League of Cities, and they're neutral. I would like to say that the small cities support this bill, but I've only heard that through a third person. I have not talked to them directly. But I certainly will have that information before this is ever voted upon on the floor. With that, if you'd like to have the opposition come up and testify, then I could counter some of their fears.
Representative Howes, what was the task force? It just says the task force here. What's the name of the task force?
The task force is the Municipal Boundary Adjustment Advisory Task Force. The chair was Bruce Johnson, an assistant chief administrative law judge. The Senate members were Senator Rick Olsen and Senator Steve Dill. The House members were Representative Paul Marquardt and Representative Doug Magnus, and there were some city representatives and township representatives, three from each side, that sat down and spent many meetings and a lot of hours discussing this, and they talked even about townships having the right to vote, which is another issue that I'd like to carry forward, but we seem to always lose that one. But the, again, the only recommendation that came through is that this should go back to the pre-2006 process.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. This task force was the recommendation of the local government committee in 2006. Prior to, we worked on this in 2005 and the local government committee. We worked on it for 2 years. There was a problem in the state with annexation and detachment, and it had festered for years and years and years. And so Chair Mark Olson and I was on the committee at the time. We worked for 2 years to get to the point where we made a lot of corrections in past annexation problems. There were some problems that we simply could not solve, and that was mainly because of the disputes between cities and townships as far as their annexation procedures. So we, at that point, appointed a task force to try to come up with the a solution for these really sticky problems that we couldn't solve after 2 years of negotiations. This particular one that he's on House File 753 on line 2.1 was not one of the sticky problems. That was voted on unanimously by the local government committee. There was no dispute about that particular portion because it was between two cities. In other words, two cities that currently provide police and fire protection and the things that townships don't. This would prevent one larger city from annexing, say, a nice piece of commercial property from another neighboring smaller city that could not defend themselves in court without, and they wouldn't have the proper amount of funds to take care of the situation for their own people. So that was not disputed. The task force was to handle the areas that were under dispute. From what I understand, there's a landowner in the state who wants to have this changed, so that's why it's before us today. Is that, and Representative House can correct me if that's not accurate.
Madam Chair, Representative House, you're real close, but the task force went from September 24th, 2007 through January 2009, and it brought forward a lot of, it talked about a lot of things, and obviously there were new things that were born as they were going through this process. And I guess the point I was trying to make is this task force, when all was said and done, the only recommendation they made was the second paragraph of that handout I gave. And again, this isn't to say that an owner can go to a city that adjoins another city and say, I want to move from this one and go to you, and you give me a resolution, and it happens. You still go before an administrative law judge. And no administrative law judge, after looking at all the evidence, if he or she sees that it's going to harm one of those cities or that owner or other owners, they're not going to follow through with that. But that's up to the lodges. That's the process we use for years. And I think a few years ago there was a bump in the road or a pothole that you changed it, and so be it. But this advisory task force looked at this again and thought, no, if we do it this way and the few changes that I mentioned, they felt it would be much better to do it that way. And again, everyone presents their case to the administrative law judge, much like I'm presenting my case to you, this committee. And I think that's doing it that way is a much better way to do it. And I could list, it's not just one landowner. I have a whole list of cities and people in cities that want this changed and think it's a good idea.
Representative Scalzi.
And thank you, Ms. Chair. And if that's the case, then we should hear from those cities who want to give up commercial or industrial property to a neighboring city who may want to take that property. We should hear from those particular cases if there is a problem, because I don't see that on here. Other than, I know that there's been people that have lobbied, but I only know of one case, and that was in the Eastern Metro area. So if you have lots of cases, I think you should bring that. But the committee should understand that this annexation problem is a huge political football. And the reason this was only one city can take from another city was a political insert during, as I understand it, it was a political insert in a conference committee at one point to please somebody. And at the time we addressed this in 2006, we wanted to make sure that those kind of shenanigans wouldn't happen, that there may be cases where property in one city would fit better in another city, and in that certainly both cities should be able to be on equal footing, and maybe one city would not want to lose that. And maybe we'd want to hear from those cities, if this is really a case, we should hear from those cities to do an overarching bill like this that would allow the city of Minneapolis to take an industrial property from St. Anthony. So we have to be very careful if we do a bill that allows a large city to be able to do something to a little tiny city. They're both creations of the state. They both provide police and fire. If we let one do it, we could be on a slippery slope.
Well, Representative House.
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, maybe we should have the two entities that want to testify against this bill, but let me say again and repeat it. Minneapolis will not take something from adjoining city just like that. They still have to go through the whole hearing process. Everyone presents their evidence, and the administrative law judge will make that decision. And probably one of the reasons attorneys have the best jobs in the state is I'm sure someone would appeal it, and we'd have more attorneys. I'm sorry, Representative Winkler, but it's a jobs committee is what it is. So with that, maybe those folks that want to testify against.
Just one.
Representative Scalzi.
Just one little point. It's not free to go before an administrative law judge. You do have to hire legal counsel. Mm-hmm. And for a small city, it's very difficult. For a large city, it's not difficult. So we just have to keep that in context, because I know of a case where it was extremely expensive. So this is the danger.
Representative House, I was just curious if you had a chance to talk to Representative Markward, who was part of the task force that made this recommendation. I don't know where he is. I'd track him down and make him testify, but I don't know where he's at.
Madam Chair, I didn't know his name was on here, and I didn't see this task report until this morning. So I knew it was out there, and I didn't find it till this morning.
Okay. Okay, I guess we will take did Bruce Meset, city manager for Lake Elmo. Might have said your name wrong. I'm not sure. And then Todd Olson, Metro Cities. If you could just state your name and your association for the tape before you start.
First. Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name, for the record, is Todd Olson with Metro Cities. And just to be clear, we don't have a position on this bill. I'm just here to kind of help share some information on this. We don't have a policy specifically to deal with concurrent detachment and annexation. That's why we don't have a position on this bill. Annexation can be a costly process. There's no solution for annexation. I was always looking for best practices, looking for further study. And we just want to remind people that the Met Council encourages, but it does not require or mandate, that cities plan for orderly annexation. And as an organization, we support striving for orderly annexation. And because of that encouragement from the Met Council, most cities in the metro area have language that honors neighboring municipal boundaries. So that's one thing we just want to make sure is clear for the committee in the metro area.
Thank you.
Bruce. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Bruce Messel. I serve as the city administrator in the city of Lake Elmo in Washington County. Prior to that, I served as the city manager in the city of Moorhead up in Clay County, in fact, with Representative Markward, although he was not my direct representative. Representative Lanning was for Moorhead. First of all, to make it clear, the city of Lake Elmo is not in opposition to this bill. It is, however, expressing serious concerns with portions of this bill, and it is exactly for the same reasons that Representative Scalzi has mentioned, as well as Representative Markward during his study, and actually with Representative Howes. I think that there's an alignment here. So if I may just briefly give the position of the city of Lake Elmo, who is going through a process right now under 414.06, and so we have direct experience with this. First of all, in summary, we're concerned that this is a solution looking for a problem, since this was really put to bed in 2006, and the annexation wars, as they were called back then, really have ended. And it has ended in part because of the encouragement of the legislature for harmonious, simultaneous, concurrent planning for annexation being done through less competition and more cooperation. And so we're concerned that you might be resetting the clock back and actually creating a position of restarting the border wars. And that is a concern to us as a community that is striving to retain a rural character and is being surrounded by urban environments where we are facing those big, bad fights and the costly legal examples of those. With that being said, however, we want to note in particular that we are very supportive of the change in Section 2 because that, in fact, is what should be, in our opinion, the legislative intent, and that is if both cities and the property owner agree, it shouldn't go through a long and costly process and should just be done and signed. And that is, in fact, orderly annexation. Our concern with changing Section 1 in particular and our opposition is really based upon three points. First is we've been through those costly border wars when it was one city. We had an example where a neighboring city did pass a resolution with the support of a property owner in Lake Elmo, and we found ourselves in a very, very costly legal battle and went through the entire process. Now, it is in a different environment now. It's in the Office of Administrative Hearings, but it cost the city of Lake Elmo thousands of dollars and hundreds of hours of staff time, and ultimately we prevailed. But it was a very costly effort, and it also created a very bad relationship between two communities and two elected bodies for many years. And to have that happen on a regular basis seems to run counter to the cooperative nature of government that you're asking us to do now. Second is it's our opinion that changing Section 1 runs afoul of good government policy and good planning. As was mentioned, the Metropolitan Council strongly encourages cooperative and simultaneous concurrent detachments when they are undisputed. And we need a mechanism to do that, and Representative Howes in Section 2 has addressed that. But just to give you an example of what the Met Council requires, I just want to share with you a couple of examples. In Grant Township's comprehensive plan, it reads, Grant will oppose any attempt by other communities to annex properties within the city. Grant will consider the merits of any requests to annex properties into Grant unless the other communities involved are opposed to such annexations. In addition, Oak Park Heights, after our costly fight in 2006, changed their comprehensive plan, and it now reads this: extraterritorial growth will only occur at the request of the property owner and agreement by the adjoining jurisdiction. The goal suggests active cooperation with surrounding cities and townships, as well as Washington County, to assure that the city and rural areas will not have land use conflict. And I could go on. We have examples of Stillwater Township, example of Stillwater the city, examples of Woodbury and our neighbors, examples of Oakdale. So since 2006, we've been on a cooperative planning endeavor, not a conflicting endeavor. And we're very concerned that this would basically create zoning shopping, that if you're not satisfied in your own community, you simply go up front to another elected body and create that conflict up front. Third is this seems to run completely contrary to your efforts to force governments and to encourage governments to cooperatively plan, to save resources, to work together through joint powers agreements, and to really go after these type of relationship building efforts, not in conflicting efforts and wasting precious taxpayer dollars. With respect to Section 3, we are not opposed, however, to the idea that there should be a reasonable way to initiate the process when not all parties agree. However, I would suggest that this needs further review and refinement before it goes forward. And as a city going through this, we would love to work within either a study effort or a quick effort with the author to talk about what that threshold is. And here's why it is of concern to us. If two out of the three parties want to initiate the process, or even one out of the three, just the property owner, the problem is that the threshold right now is so low to start the process and the cost is so high to the parties that it really becomes basically a conflicting or what we call a zoning shopping endeavor. In other words, just by filing a petition, you can start a process under 414.06 without either party being involved or being noticed beforehand. As a result, both parties are now in a very costly process through the Office of Administrative Hearings just to address one property owner's issue. So if you change the dynamics and go to a two-thirds or a one-third, our suggestion is either lower the initial cost to cities by having some sort of a pre-discussion with the Office of Administrative Hearings, as opposed to going through that entire process. I think that you can do that without spending hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars of cities, and you might even be more friendly to property owners and cities. For instance, in our case, if our property owner wants to question, there should be a process for that person to question without actually starting the official administrative hearing process, which requires the Met Council to get involved, both cities to get involved, and go through a very cumbersome process over several months. Finally, the reason why we would encourage that is because some sort of lower threshold for that first look, as you said, for the legitimacy look, would really get rid of some of the frivolous cases. The cases where, for instance, somebody has not gone through the reasonable land use steps. In our particular case, this property owner has not sought a rezoning, has not sought a comprehensive land use amendment, and so therefore, for the last 6 years, has had no contact with the city. We don't know whether their use could be accommodated within the city of Lake Elmo. In addition, we're on the third different city council from the last time they even approached the city formally with the land use question. So by lowering the cost to the cities to address that first, if that's the desire of the author, we think you could actually make a better process. Finally, I would just note that what we really are after here is trying to end the zoning shopping. The idea that if I'm not happy with my city, I'll just go to the border city, go to their legislation, get them to pass a resolution, and all of a sudden we find ourselves in a formal conflict. And that conflict is disingenuous to the goals of cooperation. It runs afoul to the Met Council, and it ends up costing taxpayers unnecessarily. So if this bill is going forward, we would encourage you to work on Section 3 to require a low threshold, but also a low cost for that initial test, that initial look, to see whether it needs to go forward. I don't know if that's the purview of the legislature, it's the purview of the Office of Administrative Hearings, but it seems to me that that would address the spirit of what you're attempting to do in this bill, which is to try to give property owners a right, as well as a case where we're not all on the same page up front. But what it does is it would remove the upfront conflict where we're trying to shop cities against one another. In summary, we are actually supportive of portions of this bill, but we're very concerned as a community that's gone through this, that this could end up wasting taxpayers' dollars and still not result in good public policy. I will tell you this, Lake Elmo is no friend of the Met Council, as you know, and we are a strong property rights city, and we want to make this work. So we would love the opportunity to work with Metro Cities, the League of Minnesota Cities, and the author to make this the best bill possible, but preserve the good public policy that was established in 2006 when we finally ended the border wars. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Madam Chair, I've not seen the Met Council mentioned here, and is the implication that the Met Council would be involved if Hermantown or some area around Duluth or the rest? Okay, so the Met Council is only involved when it's a metro city to city, and so counties aren't involved. You know, maybe we should get some language to take out a bureaucratic layer if the Met Council is costing the cities a lot. But on this, I think we need something that would protect citizens from changing and evolving rules that, you know, business is existent in the city, things change, and now undue duress is put on them. And I like having an option of where they can go to a city that is less dramatic in business relations. And so, I commend the idea of coming to an agreement language wise, but I honestly think that if you wait for a bad behaving city to agree, you might be waiting for a long time. So I support this bill. And if you get with the author and improve it, I support it even more.
Thank you. Did you have a particular question for anybody or do you wanted to address? Mr. Meeson?
Mr. Representative, thank you for the comments. By the way, I grew up in Duluth, so we've avoided the Hermantown-Duluth battle. So your comment on the Met Council, I would like to clarify. The Met Council does not mandate cities' involvement. However, if there is an Office of Administrative Hearing that involves cities within the geographic area of the Met Council, they are required to put in a very significant report to the Office of Administrative Hearings. So they're involved in terms of having to produce documentation as almost a fourth party. That was my reference to that. It was not a reference that it would be statewide. But thank you for your comments, and we would appreciate the opportunity.
Madam Chair.
Representative Howell.
Well, I was wondering if I had an amendment for this bill to take the Met Council off your back, would you then support it?
You don't have to answer.
You don't have to answer that, Mr. Reason.
I did say Lake Elmo, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay, are there any other questions? Are there anybody else in the audience that needs to testify to this bill? Okay, then hearing no other discussion, Representative Quam renews his motion that House File 753 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay?
No.
Motion does prevail. And we will move on to the next bill. Oh. We'll recess for just a second as we look for Representative Hornstein from in taxes. Oh, yes, I think Representative Stensrud had brought some pastries in. So, if you'd like to go grab one.
Didn't help his bill.
Well, that's because I forgot to mention it. Committee will come back to order. Representative Hornstein, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chairman and Chairwoman, I'm really appreciate. I was just up with Greg Davis, but I really appreciate your help. No, thank you, Mr. Representative Erdahl. If it was a cheeseburger, maybe. Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 852 to pass and then be referred directly to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Hornstein.
And again, thanks to your bill. Madam Chair and committee members. I was upstairs with another bill. I feel like it's the end of session already, but maybe that's a harbinger of things to come. House File 852 makes technical changes to a 2008 special law that allows Minneapolis to impose a park dedication fee on new net residential housing units and new commercial industrial development in the city. And just sort of the Cliff Notes version of this, the history of this bill, especially because we have so many new members here. In the 2005 and 2006 biennium, I was asked to carry this legislation that at that time was simply enabling legislation, enabling Minneapolis to have the same kind of dedication fee. And if we can get a page, I'll pass out this table. This is a list of communities primarily in the metro area, the seven counties, that have the exact same park dedication fee that Minneapolis asked and then received from the legislature in my bill that was passed and signed by the governor in 2000, and again in that, I believe, 2006. And so in discussing this bill, the city council and park board began the process of implementation, and then we got additional authority in 2008 to add this commercial and industrial development in the city. But yet there's still one more technical tweak that needs to happen. So, Madam Chair, members, I'm really hoping the third time's a charm here so that we can move on from this bill and have the park board and city council finally develop an ordinance, which is really the goal of this. At its core, this bill is about local control, simply allowing Minneapolis to have the same ability that other communities in the region have. And so the ultimate policy here will be determined by the Minneapolis City Council. So, but we're here today because in the process of then developing this ordinance after the second time this bill was passed and signed into law by Governor Pawlenty in 2008, the City and Park Board determined that the fee should also apply and address a chapter in law 462, chapter 462, which deals with the park dedication fees. And there was a legal question raised as to whether the authority would address the kind of development that we have in Minneapolis, which is infill development as opposed to the greenfield kind of development that you have in the many of the communities that are listed in the handout that I just circulated to the committee. So the city and the park board are seeking this legislation to clear up this issue and you know, be on solid footing in terms of the legal basis to impose the fee, and the city also wants to make it clear that the fee can be collected as part of the building permit issuance process. The other provisions of the law remain intact. The ordinance does comply with the other sections of Chapter 462, and I'm not a Chapter 462 expert. I'll admit to that, but we have representative from the city attorney's office and the Minneapolis Park Board who can speak a little bit more to Chapter 462, which is what this legislation attempts to deal with. Again, we're seeking just a technical change to this bill, and I will defer to our testifiers.
Thank you. Welcome to committee.
Hello, committee members. My name is Eric Nilsson. I'm with the Minneapolis City Attorney's Office, and Representative Hornstein stated correctly, the 2006 and then 2008 special laws allowed the city and the park board, because of our unique structural aspects in Minneapolis with those two bodies, to jointly exercise the authority granted by MnSTAT 462.358 with regard to park dedication. The what we found is that the legislation authorizes the city and park board to impose a park dedication fee on net new housing units. I would argue that there's implied authority therein to impose that fee in conjunction with the construction permit or building permit required for those units. But we felt that the legislation required a clarification to make that explicit and express. And that's really what this is. It's a clarification of our authority. Because we're a built city, most new development does not implicate or does not involve a platting or a subdivision. And so if we stick with just the general statutory authority, which does have a lot of relevance for outstate communities and greenfield development, but is very difficult to apply for a built city, that we felt this technical clarification would be needed. The second aspect of it is the ability to impose a flat fee, and that is just an express clarification. Both bodies, City and Park Board, acknowledge that the general statutory authority contemplates a rationale that's tied to the fair market value of the land. The rationale that we establish or intend to establish would have a tie to the fair market value of the land, but would be a flat fee that would be significantly less. And in that sense, with the different land values in Minneapolis, the different densities of developments, we felt that a flat fee would be easier to administer. And in the sense of, from a development perspective, I think it would provide some certainty by having a flat fee about what they could expect with a new development. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have just a very short time, and I know there are several people that other people that wanted to testify. Did Representative Quam, did you have a quick question? Or
yes, Madam Chair. I just want a clarification of, you know, generally the intent was for acquiring or improving. Is this fee going to maintenance, or is this going for improvement projects to the parks?
Mr. Nelson?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. The legislature already clarified that in several years ago by stating explicitly that a park dedication fee shall only be used for capital improvements, for acquisition, development, or improvement of parks, trails, recreational facilities, etc. It shall not be used for ongoing operations or maintenance. And we've also similarly put that same provision in our ordinance.
Okay. Representative Erdahl?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Hornstein, Mr. Nelson, Mr. Workman, whoever. Just wondering, are these parks eligible for funding under any of the Met Council's programs?
Commissioner Workman?
Madam Chair, Tom Workman, Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board, and I'll be brief. Really only regional parks are funded of 100 acres or larger that are considered or categorized as regional parks. Otherwise, you're on your own.
Thank you.
Did you want to testify to, or should we?
Madam Chair, I know lunch is here soon, and the donuts are not it, but thank you for having us. I just want to say the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board supports this unanimously, as well as the Minneapolis City Council, and we're just stand ready for questions or anything else.
Okay.
Bring lunch.
Okay, at this time, I think I will have the opponents come to the table. We are supposed to adjourn at 12. If the members are okay, we'll take a few extra minutes so that we can vote on the bill. If the witnesses could limit their testimony to just a couple minutes, that would be very helpful. We have Scott Pekarek, Steve Mann, and Arnie Gregory. If there's anyone here that could, any of you three here? Welcome to the committee, and if each of you could state your name and who you're with before you begin your presentation, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, thank you for having us. We have some material to distribute. If there's a page available, maybe we can have that material.
Sure.
There are several documents. Madam Chair, my name is Steve Mann. I am with the firm by the name of Loopy Development, a Minneapolis-based development firm that does affordable housing, for-sale housing, rental, commercial property, and some industrial development as well. We've been in business since 1989. We are members of the Builders Association of the Twin Cities, the State Association of Building, and also the National Apartment Association. My concern in my personal capacity and in my business capacity is that this is essentially a cost shift by the City of Minneapolis and the Park Board. What we would ask you to do is not pass this bill and have give the Park Board and the City the opportunity to rethink their strategy here. If they want to expand their capital budget, they should do so in the daylight of a tax levy and let the voters vote on it rather than a dark room deal, which is essentially a tax on developers and on new development that nobody in the public will actually see. I'm distributing some material to you, both my remarks in case we run out of time, which I anticipated being the last item on the agenda, but also the actual ordinance. Brief history, if I may, Minneapolis has a population of over 384,000 today, but in 1950 it had over 522,000 people. Today it has 200 acres of parkland more than it had in 1950 when it had over 140,000 more people. That's 140,000 people less in 1950 and 200 more acres of parkland. Minneapolis has already designated in a publication known as National Geographic Top 10 Green Cities in the U.S. It's already the number one city in the country in terms of parkland per capita. Who are we trying to beat here? We're already number one in terms of parkland per capita. Yet the parkland claims, according to the Urban Land Institute guidelines, that it needs to add almost 385 acres of parkland based on projected growth over the next 30 years. Projected growth over the next 30 years is actually 0.0084% per year growth. And they're projecting a 23% growth in park lands taken off the tax rolls and put into the park system. Minneapolis is a dense city. It was built starting in the 1840s, and taxpayers and fee owners since the 1840s have paid their taxes and built the best park system in the country. There is no room to replat or subdivide Minneapolis any further. And in fact, all those taxpayers from time immemorial, from the land grant to today forward, have all paid their taxes to build that system. The ordinance, as Minneapolis Park Board and the city have provided, is intended for the acquisition, development, or improvement of lands. And frankly, that's an illegal tax on a unique class of owner. I know there are a few lawyers here on the committee. I'm not one of them. But I'm told it fails on the taxation representation standard and also on the Commerce Clause, and that you're taxing a unique class of people without providing the nexus of benefit. And nexus is really the important question. Your existing statute already provides for the concept of nexus. There must be a direct link to the benefit of the property owner who has to deed the land or pay the fee to Minneapolis Park Board in order for the Park Board and the Council at Minneapolis to take the land. I think, frankly, there was some lack of candor in what the real intent here is. This is not a technical correction. Minneapolis knows that they cannot affect the statute on their ordinance because it does not comply with subplatting or subdivision statutes, and they don't meet the nexus test. They know that. Our notes and their public record, which I have and can provide to the page, already admits they will have a problem with nexus and need this special bill. It's already in their public record. It's in their committee report. Any expansion of jobs, any new warehouse, any new manufacturing facilities, any new rental housing, any company growth would be taxed under this statute. And not just a little tax, a big tax. A new office tower in downtown Minneapolis with 5,000 employees would pay $1 million in park dedication fees. The new Coroplast headquarters that the city was so proud to put on the river 2 years ago would have paid over $200,000 in park dedication fees. They only have 400 employees. A new apartment building of just 100 units, a standard 100-unit parcel on 1 acre of Minneapolis land, would pay $150,000 in park dedication fees. As I mentioned, 99.5% of Minneapolis is platted already. No expansion of Minneapolis is possible. Schools are actually being closed and sold off. There is 40% less park buildings open for winter activities, for skating or other winter activities in the park system since 1990. Trails, parkways, walkways are less cared for today than they were 20 years ago. The park board cannot even manage what it has. This new tax doesn't meet the nexus test, as I indicated, and it is unfortunate but real that they are trying to replace their lost NRP monies and raise taxes to support growth of facilities of lands that they've had in their portfolio for over 30 years. They've added almost 35 acres of land in their portfolio to date that they have not done anything on in terms of integrating into their system. few final points, and I'll let my colleagues speak. Of course, the city of Minneapolis adds a 5% administrative fee to this collection. The park tax is indexed to go up, but their ordinance specifically says it will never go down if the CPI goes down. Minneapolis' own planning commission viewed the ordinance as, quote, not ready for prime time, unquote. The park board gets to manage and control the special fund. If that's not the fox in the hen house, I don't know what is. And, of course, once they expand the park system, we'll need new taxes to manage, maintain, and operate the new parks. That will be a given. Madam Chair, thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Arnie Gregory. I've been in the real estate development business for the most part in Minneapolis for the past 25 years. I have a company called Greco Real Estate Development. We have been responsible for approximately 1,500 units of new and renovated housing over the past 20 or 25 years, all within the city of Minneapolis. I am here for a much different reason than Steve, and my testimony is really on the practicality of what is before you here today. There is no city in the state of Minnesota that's more expensive to develop in than in Minneapolis. Most all new development is really redevelopment. All of the soils are tainted. We have significant land costs to overcome before we even get started. As we all know, times have been very, very difficult over the course of the last 4 or 5 years. And I'm going to talk about four projects that I have been involved with, either completed recently or on the drawing board, that if this tax or if this dedication fee is implemented, none of these projects that I'm going to speak to you about would occur. In 2007, I completed a 242-unit apartment building called Blue Apartments in the uptown area of Minneapolis. It's the first LEED certified building. It's got four courtyards and a green roof. We were the first apartment building in the state of Minnesota to be granted LEED certification. It's a $48 million project that sits on land that used to pay $100,000 a year in real estate taxes. We created 100 plus jobs in the development or the construction of this building. We paid over $300,000 in permit fees to the city of Minneapolis. We pay over $700,000 a year in property taxes on land that used to pay $100,000 a year in property taxes. BIT is my equity investor in this project. Obviously, the size of it, no one individual could do. So they did it because they wanted to create jobs for the building community. I'm trying to return to them an 8% return on their equity, and I'm currently 98% full at $2 rent. So my average rent is $1,550 a month, and I'm able to return to them barely a 5% return. So obviously, the relationship here is on cost. As costs go up, returns go down. This deal would not happen today if these dedication fees had to be paid. We have just broke ground November 1st on another project in Uptown, 216 units, also funded by BIT. It's called Flux Apartments. It's $39 million in cost. We have over 100 plus jobs. That's the reason BIT did the development. We paid over $250,000 in permit fees, and our estimated real estate taxes are $600,000 on a parcel that was paying $46,000. We had about $400,000 of soil correction work before we started. This park dedication legislation bill would have cost Blue Apartments an additional $350,000 in permit fees, and it would cost Flux about $325,000 in permit fees. Once again, I don't think this development would get off the ground if this were implemented. And finally, I have two historic rehabs that I'm working on in the city of Minneapolis, downtown. They're both 120 units. They're both $25 million in cost. And I am struggling to make these things work. One of them, I'm anticipating doing 50% affordability, so 60 units are affordable. So those 60 units don't pay the fee, but the 60 units of market rate do. I don't understand that. So the affordable people are not going to use the park system, but the market rate people are? It doesn't seem fair to me. it feels a little bit of the have and the have-nots, quite frankly. I just think in times like these, you don't see a lot of people. I feel very fortunate to have some projects to work on over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, and I think it would be irresponsible to implement a fee that would kill the very heart and soul of creating those projects, thus creating those jobs. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Mr. Pekarik. If you could keep your, I hate to rush you, but we are 10 minutes already past, so if you could keep your comments short, that'd be great.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to speak today. My name is Scott Pekarik. I'm a Minneapolis resident, rental property owner, and a member of the Minneapolis Taxpayers United organization. We're a taxpayer advocacy group here in Minneapolis. I'm here to speak out against House File number 852. That seems, at face value, seems relatively benign. It's for the parks and recreation, something that I enjoy. And if they're looking for money, there must be a good reason that they need the funding. The fears, the fees seem to be directed solely at developers, which doesn't really apply to me. So what do I care? And then finally, the ordinance states that 26,000 new households are going to be created in will be added by 2030, something that will make the parks too crowded. I just want to point out a couple things here, just briefly piggyback on Steve's point. The Census Census Bureau reported that the population in Minnesota, or Minneapolis, was 382,618 people in 2000. That actually went down in 2008 to 382,605 people. I guess alone tells you that the stats, the numbers that they're using to say that the population is going to increase are disingenuous. Second, we feel that these fees, while they're directed at developers, are a backdoor tax that will ultimately hurt renters in the area. These costs are generally passed on to end users, and ultimately consumers, renters, and businesses suffer. And then finally, the Parks and Recreation Department, I briefly took a look at their numbers. Their funding actually increased from $45 million to over $47 million this year. We feel that a better use, a better way for the parks to deliver higher quality service and more options is to economize and merge duplicate operations with either the city or the Three Rivers Park District. Options there would include a separate, eliminating the separate 70-person police department, looking for ways to eliminate separate waste hauling crews and contacts. Anyway, sorry, with due lack of time, I'll wrap up here. We really feel that with the dramatic increases of over 400% in vacant building fees, over 400% in rental conversion fees in the last few years, that the city of Minneapolis and the park board should look at other options rather than impose this fee. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for any of the witnesses? Thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Hornstein, did you want to wrap up? Okay. Representative Hornstein renews his motion that House File 852 be recommended passed and be placed on the general register. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
No.
Nay.
The motion does prevail, and House File 852 will be placed on the general register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Meeting adjourned.